Hello, hello. Come on in. I am Pastor James. I'm here at the Glenwood Moravian Community Church in Madison, Wisconsin, and this is The Essentials, a podcast where we explore our faith a little bit more, celebrate good news and hope that's out there in the world. This is a continuation of our Moravian 101 class. It's been our Lenten study on Wednesday nights here at church, diving into the history of the Moravian Church, where we came from, and how we made our way to the church that we are in the world today, the unity that we see around the world. This is our third session. Last time we left off with Luke of Prague, who helped bring about some Moravian theology through the essentials, ministerials, and the incidentals. And today we'll take things from Luke of Prague to two of the biggest figures in our history. And not only big in our history, but have the biggest impact on the world in general. We think of John Amos Comenius, who's known around the world as the father of modern education. And with all the tremendous work he did with education, he was also a bishop of the unity of the brethren and walked them through a very difficult time. So we'll talk about Comenius, and then we will talk about Zinzendorf. He was with the Moravians and helped them establish their community in Herrnhut. He was with them during their spiritual renewal, and it was his leadership that helped them start the greatest Protestant mission movement that the world has ever seen. So Comenius and Zinzendorf are known for their incredible insight and their ability to lead through important times, not only in Moravian history, but they're key figures for Christianity and the world in general, too. So as you think about Luke of Prague, kind of the route it took from Luke of Prague to get to Comenius, Luke of Prague was around in the early 1500s. There's a little bit of overlap between him and Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. But as he's getting later into his life, Luke of Prague is not having as much energy for abstract theological debates. He's more interested in how people live as Christ in the world. But as Luther is gaining momentum for his Reformation, and as Luther is pulling from the work of Huss and his followers and is curious about Luke of Prague and the work that the Unity does, there's going to be some overlap between the Unity through Luke of Prague's leadership and the work that Martin Luther is taking on. Now, as they discussed, as they collaborated to help shape the Reformation, they did have a few key areas where they were able to work together. They published a few books. They worked on a catechism together. The eventual Confession of 1535 that Martin Luther writes is something that has the help and voice of Luke of Prague as well. But they did have some key differences. And the differences between the two came in communion and baptism. For communion, Martin Luther was a little put off that Luke and the brethren wouldn't kneel before the consecrated bread and wine, saying that they were undermining the presence of Christ there in the sacrament. But Luke didn't want to demand any more precision from the Bible than what was provided in the Bible. It wasn't important to him how Christ was present in the sacrament of communion. And then thinking about baptism, Luke of Prague had a belief that is still in practice in the Moravian Church today, where if an infant is baptized, it is the beginning of a sign of hopeful future faith. That infant can't proclaim faith for themselves in that moment, so their baptism is pointing to the future, pointing to their confirmation when they're able to confirm their faith themselves. It's almost as if it's the beginning step to future faith in this child. And Martin Luther thought that the water in baptism cleanses sin and it is a complete and full act in itself. That confirmation doesn't need to be part of what we're thinking of when we go through baptism. But although they did have these disagreements, Martin Luther commended Luke and the brethren for their willingness to break away from the papacy, to reconsider how the sacraments are put in place, to have this desire to start a different Christian community. Martin Luther, of course, famously nailed the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door. He is the real engine for the Protestant Reformation. And much of it is sparked by, as he's lecturing at Wittenberg, as he's studying the New Testament, he reaches the conclusion that we as Christians are justified by our faith, not by our works. That God will save us alone because of our faith in Jesus, not because of anything we do. It's a classic faith versus works debate. And Martin Luther believed that our faith alone saves us and makes us whole. But as Luke of Prague will pass away in 1528, the Reformation is very much still underway. The next leaders of the Inner Council of the Unity would continue to collaborate with the key reformers of the time. It was a mix of establishing their own beliefs, of sharing their theology with those who were part of the Reformation, but also collaborating and working together at times, adopting some practices that were becoming more common in the Reformation. Luke of Prague was a big believer in the need of theology and beliefs to evolve and change as time goes on. And ironically, that belief, this need for change, is what encouraged the Inner Council to step away from some of Luke of Prague's teachings and adopt more common practices during the Reformation. Luke of Prague would have wanted to keep all seven sacraments that were practiced in the Catholic Church in a Protestant way. And those in the Inner Council, moving on after Luke of Prague, adopted a more simplistic view, maintaining baptism and communion as the sacraments of the church, with others being rites or rituals that we practice but aren't sacraments themselves. As time was going on, there was a little bit of hope that the relationship between Protestants and Catholics could be peaceful. There was a window of time in the 1540s where it seemed like they could get along and tolerate each other, but those hopes would be quickly dashed. In 1547, Ferdinand is gains the crown of the Roman Empire, and he has very strict anti-Reformation views. He would forbid the brethren from even worshiping in their own homes. Churches were barricaded. Preachers would be arrested. And with Protestant activity not being tolerated at all, made life for the Unity difficult in Bohemia. Because they were so suppressed in Bohemia, it led to them shifting the center of their church to the area known as Moravia. Now, in Moravia, John Amos Comenius would be born in 1592, so roughly 60 plus years after Luke of Prague's death, as the Unity continued leadership through others in the Inner Council. And Comenius would go on to be a huge figure, not just for the Unity, but for the world with his work in education. But he did not have a very easy childhood. And not an easy childhood, his life had plenty of complications and challenges as well. He was born in the region of Moravia. He would be orphaned at the age of 12. And for 4 years, he was sent away to school. And that experience in school shaped his view of education tremendously. When he was 16, he was able to go to one of the brethren's best schools. And it was there that his teachers nicknamed him Amos, which is a play on the Latin word amor, because of his love for learning. Throughout his childhood, his teachers noticed how much he loved to learn, how brilliant he was. So this nickname Amos came from his desire to learn as much as he could. It was a nickname that he would then reaffirm, not just for his love of learning, but because of the biblical prophet Amos, was an advocate for social justice. He saw he related to Amos quite well. Comenius would be ordained in the unity in 1616, and then he would be made the pastor at the Fulneck congregation, which was the largest German-speaking congregation that the unity had. At about this time, there was roughly 200 unity congregations and roughly 50,000 members within the unity of the brethren. Shortly after he was ordained, as he's continuing to live in this tense period of religious and political conflict, he finds himself at the center of it quite often. In 1618, Ferdinand II, a grandchild of Ferdinand who had the throne in the 1500s, Ferdinand II is given the crown of the Roman Empire, and he turns out to be even worse than his predecessors. Before he even has power, he encourages anti-Protestant demonstrations. He encourages violence against Protestants. As a sign of displeasure, to him gaining the crown, the Protestants tried to coordinate their own leader, Frederick, as a leader of the Bohemian crown. And this, of course, led to tremendous conflict between the Roman Empire and the Protestants in the area. Part of the anger from this development of Ferdinand getting the crown led to some Protestants in Prague throwing a few Catholic lords out the chancellery window. And that would be one of the key moments that started the 30 Years' War, which took place from 1618 to 1648. And it was the bloodiest conflict on European soil until the 20th century. And the Brethren would be at the center of it for much of this war. And if they weren't at the center of it, they were fleeing and living in violence to try, living in exile to try and save their lives. In 1620, there was a battle of White Mountain just outside of Prague, and that's where the Bohemian crown, where they tried to coordinate their own leader, that crown was lost. He was chased out of town. To continue his anti-Protestant desires, Ferdinand in 1621 ordered mass arrests of rebellion leaders. He went to the old town hall and had 27 figures publicly beheaded, and seven of them were from the Unity. Also in 1621, Spanish troops went to the Brethren's house in Fulneck, where Comenius was living. They destroyed the house, they destroyed Comenius's library and any manuscripts that he was working on, and totally devastated the congregation in Fulneck. Comenius was warned about this attack, so he was able to get away in time. He was able to flee and find refuge on the estate of Count Zorotin. But in that time of transition, his wife and his two young children would pass away from the plague. So, tremendous loss of not only his home and the congregation he was serving, loss of his family as well. And now he is living in exile, chased away from the place he calls home. And it's in this state, in this place of exile and wandering, that he would write one of his most famous works, The Labyrinth of the World and The Paradise of the Heart. It still holds up as one of the best pieces of literature from the 17th century. It is a fantastic read, and he writes from a place of tremendous grief. And throughout this book, this pilgrim, who's the center of the book, will go on a journey trying to discover what life is about, trying to find happiness, and often will find that what he's looking for just is not there. Early on in the book, Comenius writes this, saying, Time and again, you have shown me and promised me riches and knowledge, comfort and security. What do I possess? Nothing. What have I learned? Nothing. Where am I? I myself do not know. I know only this, that after so much confusion, so many labors, after having been exposed to so much danger, and having thoroughly wearied and exhausted my mind, I have finally found nothing but pain in myself and hatred toward me in others. So, Labyrinth was written in a place of deep despair and grief. And this pilgrim goes through this journey, this maze of a city, encountering figures and characters who are chasing all of the pleasures and successes and dreams of life, whether it's through their profession to find wealth and riches. And mirroring some words in Ecclesiastes, they find that what they're chasing is actually vanity, that none of those things matter in this life, that they aren't what's worth searching for. So this pilgrim continues to weave through the city, and when he finally reaches the center, instead of finding the answer to all of his questions, instead of finding a beast to slay or this light of progress to be found, he gets to the center and finds nothing but an abyss. There is nothing at the heart of this labyrinth. And it's here that he will hear the voice of God calling him to return to his own heart, to turn inward. And in this process, he discovers Christ in his life, and from there is able to recenter his world. And his belief in Christ, his listening to Christ, reshapes how he understands the experiences of his life. Comenius would continue to live in exile, sometimes traveling from place to place by necessity to flee from violence or responding to other violence found in the 30 Years' War. He'd be elected a bishop of the Unity in 1632 while they were stationed in Poland. So, still haven't been able to return to the Czech Republic, still in this state of wandering without protection, without the assurance that they won't find violence. The 30 Years' War finally concluded. But at the end of the war, the land in the Czech Republic was given back to a period in time when the Catholic Church owned most of the regions, leaving nothing for the brethren to go back to. And although after the war, some Reformed churches, some of those movements from the Reformation were granted legal status and were able to exist without being tolerated, without being abused and oppressed. Their existence was tolerated. The Brethren was not one of those churches. They were not allowed to worship freely. They were continued to be under the threat of violence. So throughout his life, as he serves the Unity, almost in a double life, Comenius has this tremendous impact on education. He is revolutionary for the way he put pictures in textbooks. He developed what we would think of as an encyclopedia now today, where everything you could possibly learn about a topic is there with pictures and a key. And he would start from God, the creator, and then break things down from there. During his time spent wandering in exile or hoping for safety, he would be called to various schools and universities to restructure their system of education. And his view on education, some of his ideas are very much still in practice today. The way we have schools set up from a nursery, then to elementary, to middle school, to high school, to college, was a vision that Comenius had. And he also had a belief in pantsophy, which is universal wisdom, meaning that We should learn as much about everything as we possibly can, not to specify into one area or one expertise, but to learn as much about the world around us as we can. And in doing so, we're going to learn more about our creator and more about each other. In Pansy, everything is connected. So the more we learn, the more we get in touch with our creator, the more we learn about the divine, and the more we learn about humanity as well. He also was ahead of his time in believing and advocating for universal education in a time when it was just offered to those who were rich or of means. He believed that if you were rich or poor, man or woman, you should have access to education. You should be able to learn as much as you possibly can. And he also, like many from the Unity and Moravians who would follow, had great ecumenical vision. He saw all people as being created by God. He hoped for people to collaborate rather than focus on their differences. He even regretted the fact that there were countries and borders that separated us because we all come from the same creator. Now, as the Unity continues to get persecuted, as they continue to struggle without a place where they can feel safe and worship freely, towards the end of his life, Comenius is fearing that the Unity might be running out of steam, that the future might not be so hopeful for the community. War would drive him into Sweden and then to Amsterdam, where he would eventually pass away. And as the Unity continues to struggle, he starts to plan for life after the Unity. He writes A Bequest of a Dying Mother from the perspective of the church, encouraging those in the Unity to join other reformed movements, saying that you can keep the message of Hus and his followers alive. You can keep this reformed idea going, but not as the Unity that we know it today. Join other groups that are currently in progress because the Unity will not be able to last. Towards the end of his life, he would consecrate his son-in-law. He remarries. He would consecrate his son-in-law, Peter, as a bishop of the Unity, hoping that Peter can continue on and somehow a spark can ignite again. But his son-in-law would pass away even before Comenius did. So in 1670, when Comenius does pass away, he is the last bishop of the Unity on earth. He believed there was a hidden seed, that there was something special about the Unity. He hoped maybe it could grow in the future, but he would have went to his grave thinking that the days of the Unity were seriously numbered, if not as if they had already ran out. So, as he has this tremendous impact on the Unity, as he is with them through this time of great turmoil and trouble, he also has that tremendous work in education. And it's a bit strange that the brilliant mind that he was, the amazing work he was able to accomplish, you'd think the Unity would be able to flourish and experience such great success. But for one of our leaders who was the smartest and most influential of his time, he oversaw the Unity when it almost shrank to nothing. Just incredible how he could have this amazing impact and see the Unity suffer at the same time. So Comenius passed away in 1670, and 52 years later, in 1722, members of the Unity who have been wandering in exile stumble on the land of a man by the name of Zinzendorf. And it's through his leadership and his hospitality that the Unity, the Moravian Church, is renewed. So, just a little about Zinzendorf in his life before the members of the Unity found him. He was the family of German royalty. He was a German nobleman. He had an incredible incredibly comfortable upbringing. His family had connections to the European elites. He would study law and government at the University of Wittenberg, but also was a deeply spiritual person. He had kind of this awakening, this conversion moment when he was younger and was committed to following Christ. And he was a strong pietist as well, which was a common practice coming out of the Reformation to take on a spiritual journey yourself, to have a personal faith, a personal desire to be spiritually renewed, and to follow a Christian life based on biblical doctrine. Eventually, he would inherit his grandmother's estate of Berthelsdorf, and it's there that these members of the Unity would stumble onto his land in 1722, and he would allow them to establish a community there so they could live in safety and build this Christian community together. Herrnhut was designed to be a place of harmony, of prayer and unity. It was a place where people walked with Christ together. They looked out for each other, they cared for one another. And as Comenius saw the community living and working together, he was inspired by them and became a leader for them. He developed something that is similar to what we can think of as piety. He thought of this idea of the theology of the heart, which says that a life of faith isn't memorizing scripture verses, it's not agreeing to creeds and long confessions of faith, that your spiritual life should be a personal relationship with Jesus, something you pursue through prayer and discernment. Through reflection, that you seek a personal connection with Jesus. Now, as he became this leader for the Moravians in Herrnhut, he would be with them during their spiritual renewal of 1727. So they've been in Herrnhut for 5 years. Over that time, some disagreements started to grow. They weren't getting along as they hoped they would, and it even got to a point where they were wondering how long this establishment could go on. How long could they live in community with each other? But on August 13th, at a worship service, as they were celebrating Holy Communion, those who were gathered there felt such an overpowering presence of the Holy Spirit that those disagreements they had faded away, and they could once again see each other as siblings in Christ. They saw the love that they shared, they saw the care they have for each other, and they were so touched by this moment that they didn't want to part company and leave worship for their evening meal. So Zinzendorf had the food brought to them where they were worshiping so they could continue this time of prayer and fellowship and enjoy each other's company. It's something we still honor today as we practice love feasts from time to time in the Moravian Church, where we pause during Sunday worship. We bring out drinks and cookies or love feast buns and just converse with one another during our time of worship. From this spiritual renewal, Moravian Pentecost, as it's sometimes referred to, a few key things came from it. One being the writing of the Brotherly Agreement, which is now known as the Covenant for Christian Living, which is a brief and concise, first kind of statement of faith and description of the beliefs that the community has, but then instructions on how we relate to one another, instructions on how our Christian faith inspires us to treat each other. And this was a voluntary agreement that those in the community signed into. And it's a covenant that's still part of our church today. It's been revised and updated, but is still a guiding principle for our church. But also, the spiritual renewal encouraged and inspired Zinzendorf to think of how they can send this message around the world. And through this desire to share this good news, this love of Christ, Zinzendorf would be part of starting the greatest Protestant mission movement that the world has seen. It began with Leonard Dober and David Nitschmann, who went to the islands of St. Thomas to serve those who were enslaved there. And over the time that the Moravians were under the leadership of Zinzendorf, over 300 missionaries would be sent across the globe. Initially, that was something there'd be mission work done locally or in other parts of Europe, and this was the first that sent missionaries to the entire reach of the globe. And it's important to note that as they sent their missionaries out, they didn't go with the goal of converting people or saving their souls, that the missionaries went with the hope to learn about the people they were meeting, to gain an understanding of how they interpret God or the divine in their life, to form relationship, and to bring the message of Christ in once you've established that relationship and you know more about each other. So as this mission movement is going on, as Moravians are scattered across the globe sharing the good news, Zinzendorf would help establish other Moravian communities. He would help them plant seeds in the Netherlands, in the Baltics, and in England as well. He had a huge hand in the biggest, maybe, Moravian settlement in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, helped guide them establish a community there that was somewhat similar to the community that they knew in Herrnhut. There in the community, they practiced communal living. They participated in a choir system, which you had your family, your spouse, your kids, but you also had, you were in a choir of people your same gender and age, or maybe profession as well, and you were responsible for looking after each other. And this commitment to each other was so great. The choirs were so established, and they were such a part of their community that in God's Acre in Bethlehem, in the cemetery there, you were buried based on your choir, not on your family. So, this idea of communal living was incredibly important to the group there in Bethlehem. He would also, Zinzendorf would help the Moravians in Europe gain a little bit more respect and gain a better status with other Protestant churches. He too had an incredibly ecumenical vision and wanted churches to collaborate and work together for the good of the gospel. And that was something he was able to accomplish in Europe to kind of get the name of the Moravian Church out there and help form some ecumenical relationships that is still vital to our experience of church today. We are in full communion with many denominations. We partner and collaborate as often as we can. It is a serious goal of the Moravian Church still today. Zinzendorf also was someone who was able to embrace emotion through his spiritual side. He wrote many hymns that are still in use today. He wrote many liturgies and helped form the idea of how important it is to have mission work be a part of your Christian life. Mission work is still incredibly valued in our church, and it springs from the vision that Zinzendorf had. So in the Moravians, in the unity, when those in exile stumbled upon to his estate, I'm sure they could have never imagined being able to establish their community and then to see how that seed that Comenius was hoping for would get planted and grow into something beyond their expectations, not just there in Herrnhut, but would spark Moravian communities, Moravian mission sites all around the globe. And we are still a worldwide unity from those efforts to send missionaries across the globe as best they could. So those are two of our key figures in our Moravian history. Comenius walking through times of violence and exile and shaping the way we understand education still today, 400 years later. And Zinzendorf, having the church see mission and service as its purpose in the world, is something we still value and have at the heart of our Moravian congregations. So that about does it for this lesson of Moravian 101. Hope you learned a little more about Comenius and Zinzendorf. Hope you understand a little more of the impact that they have had, not just on our church, but on the world as well. If you want to learn more about Moravians for yourself, if you want to do some exploring, check out moravian.org. You'll find the Covenant of Christian Living. You'll find a brief overview of these figures that we talked about today, Comenius and Zinzendorf, and how they shaped the Moravian Church that's still in existence today. So thank you for listening. Take care. I will catch you next time.